Boat Trader is America's largest boating marketplace with over 100,000 boats to choose from. We offer simple, comprehensive solutions for those looking to sell, find, and finance new or used boats. Visit BoatTrader.com to get started.
At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
Welcome to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm Matthew of CastingAcross.com, where I explore the quarry and culture of fly fishing. This is another Casting Across Fly Fishing Accusations podcast episode, where I interact with questions, comments, and the occasional accusation from viewers like you. This week, we are coming to you from the foot of the Shenandoah Mountains outside of Charlottesville, Virginia. My family and I were able to sneak down for an excellent little week and a half mini vacation. I've been able to get into trout. I've been able to get into the mountains. I've been able to get into some very, very good food, drink, and relaxation time. So all is well in the world of Casting Across. But as per usual, every 10 episodes, I turn to reader questions, comments, and accusations to give a little bit of on-air interaction. And there's some really good things to talk about this week, and actually a little bit of a look ahead as to what we're going to talk about in a few minutes. I have had more interaction on an article in the last few months than I've ever had on anything I've ever written in Casting Across history. And so I'm going to touch on one thing that was said about that article here in a few minutes. But the first thing I want to mention was actually another piece that has had a lot of feedback. It's a YouTube video, and it's the YouTube video called How to Choose a Wading Boot for Fly Fishing. And in it, I outline three things: a kayaking shoe that I use quite a bit, a lightweight wading boot, and then a heavy-duty wading boot, and talk about the pros and cons of each. And even as I sit here now looking at the video on YouTube, I see that there's lots and lots of videos on fly fishing boots and how to choose them. But I felt like this one was a particularly helpful one because it gives a breakdown of not necessarily price point, but of the support that is needed. So all that to say, Rick commented, "My first and only experience with a rubber-soled wading boot, the Sims G3 Vibram Indo-Grip Sole, almost cost me my life. If I hadn't been wearing an inflatable life vest, I would have drowned. Rubber soles of any kind are nowhere near, that's in all caps, as slip-resistant as a felt sole. What a waste of $450. I put my life ahead of concerns about transferring invasive species." Well, Rick, thank you for watching, and thank you for giving me your, unfortunately, terrible experience. So I want to say a few things. There are definitely rubber boot soles that are not created equally. And there are felt soles that are not created equally. I have used, in 25 plus years of fly fishing, some absolutely abhorrent felt soles, ones that have no business being in the bottom of a boot for safety concerns, let alone for the transfer of invasive species. And I think Rick does make a good point. Felt has become a persona non grata in the fly fishing world because of the ability for invasive species at the microscopic level to be transferred from one body, water body to another. But the reality is that there's many other porous surfaces that you carry on yourself waist down, even in fly fishing waders, where they can go from one water body to another. And ultimately, I think that fly fishers are kind of the lowest common denominator, especially in water systems where any sort of boat could, in theory, go from one place to another. So all that to say, I appreciate the invasive species issue, especially in places where things like Didymo out here on in the East Coast and some other issues across the country are a significant concern. But that being said, I have really not taken that into account when talking about the surface that I use when I am wading. But I'll be very, very frank. This week, I was fishing on a stream here in the Shenandoahs, actually in the Shenandoah National Park, that my rubber-soled boots were not very grippy on. But it was a surface that was just not going to be a great surface to fish on unless I was using heavy duty spikes. And that's because we're at the very beginning of the season and there's been enough warm weather that things are just now starting to bloom. It's a very, very slick time of year. I feel like the beginning of the season and then the very tail end of the season, on almost every stream, you run into a lot of rocks where things are just starting to bloom. The algae is just starting to come in at the beginning end, and the tail end, everything has died away and there's just a little bit of a remnant. So not enough vegetation to get a grip, but also more than you would find on just a bare rock. And so it is particularly slippery. And so I was using rubber wading boots and I slipped, but I just adjusted my step appropriately. So again, Jim had an experience. He didn't explain exactly what happened. And also at the same time, $450, I would not spend $450 on a pair of wading boots. I feel like the corkers I have, which I think run like $250, are about as extreme as you can get as far as durability and support and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, I have Sims gear and I love it, but I can't imagine spending $450 on a pair of wading boots. But I would just say that, you know, again, I'm coming from a position where I have a multiple pair of wading boots and then I have a pair of corkers, which have multiple pairs of soles. And I would match my boots to the condition. If you are in a position where you can spend $300 or $400 or $450 on a pair of one wading boots, buy two pairs of wading boots. That's my general advice. Those two pairs of wading boots, if you buy $200 pair of wading boots, they're going to last you over the course of two, three, four, five seasons as long as one pair of $450 wading boots. I promise you that. And there are situations and circumstances where rubber will exceed and outperform felt. Snow is a great example. You are taking your life in your hands, walking in frigid conditions alongside barely thawed out water in stream banks. If you are wearing felt soles, you are going to get into trouble. And so that is a situation where rubber is better. But at the same time, there's even permutations of rubber and felt. You can have felt with studs or rubber with studs. So again, there's no one fit solution for everybody. This is why something like corkers are great. And I mean, I only have one pair of corkers and I wear them probably once out of every five trips. I wear rubber-soled shoes for the other ones, whether they be shoes or wading boots. So I have really come to adapt to those and know my limitations in those. But again, I can appreciate how a bad experience, even what seems to be a life-threatening experience for Rick, could certainly turn him and anyone else off from using a particular product again. But at the same time, it's not a conspiracy where everyone's trying to use rubber simply because maybe some sort of environmental concern. Rubber does work in a lot of situations and circumstances. So I would just say, do your research, and especially if you want to spend a lot of money, instead of buying one really nice pair, buy two nice pairs. For the next bit of feedback, I am going to actually mention the most, the smallest amount of time between receiving feedback and commenting on it on one of these podcast episodes. And it's from an article that I posted yesterday called Spoils of the Hunt. And I'll mention more about it here at the end of the podcast, but it is an article talking about going used bookstore combing to try to find fly fishing books. And it was pretty good. I had a great turnout. I'll talk about that here in a minute, like I said. But Rob Snow White, that's his real name. His real name given to him by his parents. Well, but their parents gave them the last name Snow White, but that's neither here nor there. I've known Rob for a long time. I mean, really, since I started fly fishing. He worked at the Orvis store in Tyson's Corner, and that was my first fly shop job ever, was there also. And so I've worked alongside of him, known him for a long time, listened to his podcast for a number of years. Definitely check out the Rob Snow White, the Fly Fishing Consultant podcast, if you have a minute. But anyway, his comment on that article, Spoils of the Hunt, is fly anglers that don't read might as well use bait. And I would agree in a very general term. So there is something to be said for fly fishing, fly fishermen, and fly fishing literature. These things go so well together. It is an integral part of fly fishing culture. Whether it be historical, whether it be technique, whether it be people just musing about the beauty of fly fishing, it is a part of fly fishing that is really hard to get to a point where you say, hey, I'm an avid fly angler, or some might even say I'm a huge fly fisherman, and not have a couple of classic fly fishing books on your shelves. Now, again, am I trying to sound elitist? Am I trying to, you know, Harris Tweed and Wicker Creel my way into the good graces of a certain contingent of fly fishing folks? No. All I'm saying is that this is as much a part of fly fishing as caring about which rod you use, caring about rivers that are historic, caring about, you know, just even the aesthetic aspect of fly fishing, looking at a rod and a reel on a fly box and saying this is artful, and there is some value to that beyond pragmatism. And I would say the fly fishing literature falls into that category. So do you need to have a quota of how many fly fishing books you read over the course of the year? No. Are there certain books that are must reads? Like, do you not have a fly fishing street cred card if you've not read River Runs Through It? If you say, oh, I thought that was just a movie, then you will lose a little bit of credibility in my eyes. However, that's not something that you need to do. You don't need to have, you know, 9 out of 10 John Gierek books, titles memorized. You don't need to have art prints of James Prosek on your wall. You know, it's not that sort of thing. You don't need to even necessarily know which editions of Walton's Complete Angler included Cotton's addendum on fly fishing or not. I mean, those are interesting factoids, but they're not necessary to be involved in fly fishing. But it would be my strict recommendation for you to read. To be fair, I feel the same thing about a lot of other disciplines. Let me just talk about a few that I'm in. It's hard to say, oh yeah, I'm a Civil War buff if you don't read Civil War literature, whether it be narrative or historical biography or anything like that. It's hard to be a pastor. I would dare say, if you are involved in an evangelical or a conservative Christian church, and your pastor is not reading, that's an issue. I don't say that to be judgmental. It's just I can't fathom how you are in the communication business and you're not reading. And I would say that for a number of other disciplines and vocations. For hobbies, fly fishing certainly finds its way into the reading field. And so if you have questions, if you have book recommendations that you're looking for, definitely over to the website over at castingacross.com. There's a whole page full of book recommendations that I would suggest you go and check out. Or always email me, Matthew@castingacross.com. Happy to give you some book recommendations. If this is a part of fly fishing that you are not necessarily engaged in already, or if you're just like, I'm not a big reader, I've heard that so many times, okay, use audiobooks. Read Big Two Hard River by Hemingway. It's maybe 75 pages tops, like double space, right? Large, like 14-point font. But I've got more recommendations if you are at all curious. All right. Well, without further ado, the question comment that I, like I said, have received more than anything else, the feedback I've gotten more than any other in the 8+ years of Casting Across, came after an article that I wrote called Why Fly Fishing Means Something. And this article essentially explored that there's a foundation below fly fishing. There's a presupposition below and underneath and girding just the pursuit of getting out in the woods. Why do we do it? And for me, I said, first of all, family, but then ultimately faith. That's the most important thing. And it was certainly the point of the article, but it wasn't some great evangelistic, Christian piece. But I would actually, you know, go back on that and say that it is a Christian piece. And all of Casting Across is Christian because that's who I am. And that's the worldview that it's flowing out of. I make no apologies for that. Again, you know, if I write about how to tie tippet, it isn't necessarily sharing the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. At the same time, that's the world in which I believe is real, and that has evidence for, and ultimately influences how I do what I do. Right. So I articulated that a little bit more directly, and I'm doing that a lot more because, again, life is too short to just kind of dance around the important things. So a lot of folks respond to that. Some of that had to do with the fact that. Article got picked up by Midcurrent, which is a great website that shares a lot of good information. So I'm happy that I got included in that good information. But I want to share an email exchange real quick from a gent named Ken from Montana, because I think this is what I want, because I get a lot of amens and thank you and things like that. But this is what I got. So Ken says, nicely said, I admire your conviction. I wonder, how does your relationship with the Christ influence your interactions with non-Christians, specifically non-deistic Buddhists? Does your worldview, shaped as it is by your faith, relegate me to an eternal inferno? Interested in your thoughts on this. So I replied, and honestly, I'm just going to straight up read what I said because there's no sense in not beating around the bush or being vague. I said, thanks for reading and commenting, especially since we have a very different way of looking at things. The latter is all too uncommon these days. I'll answer your most pointed question directly, yes. That said, I'll add a few qualifiers. First and foremost, I was relegated to hell before God's grace. I didn't deserve the salvation I received. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and this not of yourselves, is the gift of God, not of works, so that no one may boast. And that's from Ephesians 2, 8 and 9. Which leads me to your question about interactions with non-Christians. I see my love for neighbor originating from the fact that we are both wonderfully created by God and honed by the fact that I am told to love my neighbor by the one who, quote, demonstrated his own love for us, and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. That's from Romans 5, 8. I said, I know this is a really short format for some big ideas, but I did want to answer you quickly. Thanks again, and please don't hesitate to reply. And so Ken did reply. He said, I spent a lot of time thinking about reply. As a former Catholic, I respect your position and again, am deeply impressed by your conviction. I'd rather not continue a conversation like this via email. Tons of nuance and subtleties that would get lost in the medium. Perhaps one day we can talk as thinking men would. Be well, and my very best regards. That's from Ken. So I absolutely love this. Like, this makes my day. A couple of things that Ken brought up that I think are just worth me passing on. And if this doesn't feel like fly fishing conversation, well, this is what you get with Casting Across. We go into the minutia, right? And we go into the smallest details that some people might not think matter. The design of the skeleton shape of a reel spool, and we go to the things that matter the most, which is life and the universe and everything, right? So a few things that Ken brought up that I want to touch on. First and foremost, he talked about having a difference of opinions, but having dialogue, and that doesn't happen enough these days. Absolutely. There are so many, I'll just make the same distinction that we see here, Christians and non-Christians who don't want to talk about things that they don't want to talk about, things that make them uncomfortable because there's a disagreement. And we've gotten to a place in our culture and a world where a disagreement labels you intolerant. Bringing it back to fly fishing. Can you have somebody who talks about bait fishing and talks about fly fishing, both for trout, heaven forbid, wild trout, and those two people not exist in a state of animosity towards one another? Absolutely. You may vehemently disagree, but if things are being done respectfully, then at least have a conversation, because there's a lot more common ground than there are areas of disagreement. So that's the first thing I would say, and I appreciate Ken for reaching out. There's probably a handful that did from that same perspective, and so I appreciate that. Secondly, he went right for the big questions. What do I believe about the eternal destiny of those who are outside of Christ? And I would simply say that I don't have a new and novel idea, but I hold to the exact same orthodox position, not only of the church for 2,000 years, but of Christ himself, and really ultimately going all the way back through biblical revelation to the beginning regarding that there is eternal conscious torment and punishment for those who are outside. But that we don't find the solution for that in ourselves. That comes by grace, like I mentioned earlier. That's a huge misconception, I think. It's this idea of superiority that folks either project or assume of the Christian worldview that says we've done something better, we've done something different. It has nothing to do with it. And anyone who represents it that way is completely misunderstanding at the best and deliberately misrepresenting at the worst, again, the orthodox perspective for the last 2,000 plus years. And then thirdly, the thing that I think is worth touching on is, how does my worldview interact or influence my interaction with people who don't believe? And I would actually say that fly fishing and casting across is one of the ways in which I love the amount of interaction outside of my work circles. So again, as pastoring one church and then still being on staff, kind of doing administrative work for another one, the majority of my week and my time and my interactions are spent with folks within the bubble, for lack of a better term. Casting across and fly fishing in general allow me to have those interactions with people of all different shapes, sizes, beliefs, worldview, perspectives, paradigms, you name it. And I love it. It enriches my life. It enriches my experience. It puts a certain flavor into not just my life, but also my ministry. It grounds me. It gives me opportunities to do what I talk about doing so frequently, but in a much different way, in a way that I think lends itself to being much more faithful and true to the talk that I talk. So again, I would love to have another conversation with Ken, but I'd love to have a conversation with anybody who had questions about stuff like this. There is no truth or no idea or no question that I believe that my worldview, shaped by first and foremost the historical work of Christ, but then the revelation that is in that has been included in Scripture, that I cannot answer. I might not be able to answer it perfectly. I certainly can. I have enough humility to know that there's a lot of answers that I would have to think about and maybe even say, you know, this might not be the best answer, but at the same time, I think there's an answer for everything. And really, if your worldview doesn't have that, then what's going on? what is your answer? You're having to have a lot of faith in nothing as opposed to faith in something. So again, if that's not fly fishing enough for you, then I'm sorry. There's a lot of great websites that just tell you, you know, how many turns of wire you ought to put on your hairs or your body. And by all means, go check those out. But here we do things a little different, and I think that folks appreciate that. Anyway, any questions, comments, accusations, let me know. Matthew@castingacross.com. If you don't like doing the email thing, there is a contact box somewhere on the website. You can find it. You're smart. And let me know what is going on in your head, particularly as it relates to fly fishing. This week on castingacross.com, two articles, and the first one is a piece that is actually the outflow of the last 9 episodes of the podcast, which have been my Cast One series, and I'll talk more about that in coming weeks about where that's going, but it was really talking about something that I think is worth mentioning, which is why go back to the basics, regardless of where you are in your fly fishing life/career. Why go back to the basics? And so I talk about why, if you're curious about fly fishing, you should go to the basics. If you are confused by fly fishing, you should go back to the basics. And if you are, confident, I think it was the three, you know, got to have three alliterative words. This is also kind of coming out of a lot of folks that reached out expressing their appreciation for the Cast One series, even though they've been fishing for a long time. So check out Why Go Back to the Basics over on castingacross.com. And then Wednesday's article was called Spoils of the Hunt. So as I mentioned earlier, I on vacation went to a number of used bookstores and probed the catacombs and stacks. And I came away with a few books. I'll mention them very quickly. One is Steve Rinella's Meat Eater. And so I like the Meat Eater program, just everything that they've got going on. And so I'd never read that book, that kind of the original work. So I picked that up because it was much cheaper. And then Fly Fishing the 41st by James Prosek. And this is a book that I think is the only book of James Prosek that I don't own. Then Trout Hunting by a gent named Woolner. And this one was a surprise. It just popped out to me because of the name. And it looks like he is from the North Shore of Massachusetts, or maybe Central Mass. So we probably fish in the same places. So I picked that one up for a few bucks. And then Ray Bergman's Trout. I have a copy that is very ugly, and this is a very pretty cloth-bound second edition. So not first bound, no dust jacket, but still for $9, it was very hard to pass up, or $13, something like that. But yeah, for under $40, I got 4 good volumes and spent a lot of money on my wife. And yeah, got a good lunch out of the whole deal. So why and how go to those used bookstores, talk a little bit about that. But it really is just a quick little photo essay of a number of places that I went as I hunted for books. This week's recommendation on the podcast is a pair of waders that you can't get anymore, but there's still a benefit for you to hearing about them. So I fish with probably 3 pairs of waders routinely over the course of the season, and I've been using my Orvis Silver Sonic waders, which was kind of their mid-grade a number of years ago. But it's actually a feature that I am suggesting you check out, and you can get this on, I believe, their entry level as well as their mid-level waders. So, and looking at their website now, you can definitely get it in their ultralight convertible waders, which come in at under $300, which is a steal. And I believe you can also get it on, no, you can't. It's only on their entry-level wader, it looks like. But it is the fact that you can disengage your waders from the suspenders, and in doing so, turn your waders from chest high into waist high, yet still have suspenders. So looking at a couple more of their models, that is what looks to be the case, that you can only get it in their entry level now. So that's a great little, well, I take that back, not their Clearwater, which is their entry level, but their next step up. But this is a great way to maintain your waders staying at your waist and not sliding down. I feel like wading belts do an okay job, but having your suspenders actually be the thing that keep your waders in place, I find very helpful. So all that to say, I will be putting a link to this particular pair of waders, the men's ultralight convertible waders from Orvis, on the show notes, this podcast page. Again, this is not the waders that I own, but it is this one feature and this one design element. Even just looking real quickly at these $298 pair of waders, they have the integrated gravel guards, they have the reinforced shins and knees, which all isn't just about like you sliding around your knees, but also the stress points. There's some other nice little features that you get, like you know, there's places to put your stuff on your chest, but ultimately it comes down to, are they durable? And the seams on the Orvis waders are, in my experience, durable. And then this cool little feature of unclipping your waders from being up at your chest and leaving your suspenders on, and then your waders dropping down to your waist, so that you can maybe be warmer, cooler in the summertime, or even access stuff like in your jacket pocket. So I think it's just a really cool feature, and I definitely enjoy it on the waders that I have. Thanks for listening to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. Please subscribe to your favorite podcast app and rate the podcast on iTunes. Then head over to castingacross.com for 3 posts a week on the people, places, and things that go into the pursuit of fish.
You want to succeed, you want to fish, you want to be one of the greatest.
Tune in to West Marine's Life on the Water, presented by Costa Custom Boats, every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
Every once in a while, it's fun to go with, like, just full-blown redneck on these fish. This is like high-tech cane pole fishing right here.
From the white sandy beaches to the crystal blue waters, enjoy the best fishing Panama City Beach has to offer during Chasing the Sun. Sundays at 9:30 a.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.